Avi Adoni Dodi. We enter into this study to draw close to you for the sake of holy service and the fulfillment of your will for us and for all of Israel and for this entire planet. Please assist our efforts and guide our understandings. Let us internalize your Torah to the depths of our being so that we become transformed by your will and its truths. Let neither ourselves nor anyone else come into stumbling as a result of this study. Gal enai va'abita niflaot metoratecha.
Hey.
Hi, everybody. Anybody have any thoughts, questions, comments before we drop in? We're in the epilogue. I got into the second page of the epilogue, so I think we'll start at the beginning again and just kind of go through. But that means that there's only two or three more classes for this, for the book. So I think we got to put on our thinking caps and figure out if we want to continue, how we want to continue, and try to come to some kind of consensus about that. So that's the homework for this week. Okay. Okay, I'm going to go into the epilogue. Let's see, where is it?
Page 261.
Yeah. We're really on 262, but I think we should just start on 261. Okay. Because this first two paragraphs, they really do encapsulate the book in a very helpful way, I think. The observation that prompted this work is that shame is ever present and ever troublesome in people's lives, and yet it is typically so well hidden that most folks are unaware of its menacing impact, and in particular, its role as the hidden culprit behind baseless hatred. I'm not speaking about chronic debilitating shame. That's another matter. I'm speaking about garden variety shame, the shape-shifting shame that loiters at the outskirts of awareness and, when poked, instantly diverts attention onto the flaws, i.e. the shame of someone else who serves as its scapegoat. In this way, it defends, quote-unquote, defends our ego from having to face its flaws and limitations, and the scapegoat becomes an object of baseless hatred. This shame reflex, when operating without conscious oversight, is the primary obstacle to fulfilling the mitzvot that regulate human relations, such as loving your neighbor as yourself, not harboring grudges, not taking revenge, not coveting, not flattering. The Talmud has made it perfectly clear that our failure on this front is what caused our current exile, and consequently that it will take a massive correction on this front to bring about our redemption. Yet given our intractable defenses against admitting shame, the question arises, why did Hashem design it like this? How does this further the purpose of creation? How does it contribute to the consummation of relationship between the Holy One and the Shekhinah, that is the goal of it all? And or how does it support the perfect team that is our means of attaining this goal, that goal? These are the questions that inspired this work. If we posit that the purpose of creation is to actualize the potential of relationship, that was our starting premise. We looked at the various explanations that are given classically about why Hashem created creation, and all of them entail relationship in one form or another. And so the umbrella explanation I said many times before, but I'm going to say it again. The umbrella explanation is that Hashem, before creation, by definition, was lacking nothing, except in some mysterious sense, the experience of actualized relationship, because there was no other with whom to relate. So Hashem created creation, i.e. us, i.e. Shekhinah, as an other, and entered into all the myriad faceted possibilities of relationship, some of which have already happened, and some of which, the more consummate levels of which, have yet to be realized. But all of the five explanations for why Hashem created creation are all relationships in some form or another. So if we posit that the purpose of creation is to actualize the potential of relationship, then if Hashem is the one who's creating this relationship, then it must be the most perfect relationship imaginable, even now, even with all its seeming imperfections, because it's a work in progress. So the expectation of its perfection doesn't apply at this moment, because it's still a work in progress. So even with all its seeming imperfections of now, it's similar to the paradox of perfecting, which, as we've seen, is equally a divine imperative. One of the chapters of Kabbalistic writings on the nature of masculine and feminine focuses on this mystery of perfecting, as it's explicated by Rav Kook. The consummating of relationship, the perfecting of relationship, is part of this, is one of the ways of our fulfilling this mission, this mandate of perfecting, of experiencing the pleasure of self-transformation, of perfecting, which we've seen is equally a divine imperative. Simply stated, the perfection of divinity, in order for it to be absolutely perfect, must lack nothing, including the possibility of dynamic perfecting, whereby perfection becomes even more perfect without implying that it was anything less than perfect before. Again, it's a paradox that we just have to leave it at that. But the same applies to the relationship between the Shekhinah, who includes the entirety of creation within her bones, and the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that lies at the heart of creation. As creation evolves, the Shekhinah's partnership with HaKadosh Baruch Hu matures accordingly. For as their area of overlap increases, as the Shekhinah's stature increases, their area of overlap increases, and their relationship becomes that much more consummate. I'm going to go to this figure 12 just to, because it illustrates what we're talking about. Okay, so in number one, the he and the she, HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Shekhinah, they're back to back, and they're essentially of equal stature. They eat from the tree of knowledge, and the Shekhinah can. There's a number of symbols that are essentially equivalent. So the Shekhinah, the Knesset Yisrael, and Shekhinah, Knesset Yisrael, and Adam are all pretty much synonymous terms. They might be referring to, being used to refer to a different layer of those of Shekhinah, but they're all essentially terminology that conjures, so to speak, the Shekhinah. So Adam and Chava, we're told that Adam and Chava span from heaven to earth and one end of the world to the other. They contain the entirety of creation within their bones. And so they, like as representing the Shekhinah, so include the entirety of creation. They ate from the tree of knowledge, and the Shekhinah, our feminine half of that couple collapsed and diminished, and the lights that were previously in her undiminished stature now could no longer fit into her diminished state, and so they kind of are shattered, like scattered into the universe as these, with my cursor, these sparks that kind of fell out the bottom, so to speak, of the Shekhinah. And so we then inherit that state of reality, and we are putting everything back. Our job is to put everything back together again, to go and encounter each one of those sparks. Each spark is a form of light, and light always equates with consciousness. So we, our job is to acquire, to reacquire the consciousness that we lost, and in that reacquired state, the sum of consciousness that we are holding at that point, ultimately number four on the image, is even greater than the, like it's a Yirida L'tzarich Aliyah, that there was a diminishment, and like a spring compressed and released, it drives a developmental process that ends up bringing us to a higher level than was our starting point. And so this is kind of two and three are basically our reality, where we, only part of our soul is really inside our body, and part of our soul, the still scattered pieces of it, are strewn throughout. And Hashem leads us from coordinate A to coordinate B to coordinate C, because there's a spark, a sliver of consciousness, a sliver of soul that belongs to us, that we need to collect and integrate. And so, and as we, each spark that we collect and integrate, it increases our stature. And as our stature increases, our the extent of our overlap between the Shekhinah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu increases. And that overlap, the greater the overlap, the greater the consummation of the union, the more of each one is being met by the other. And so it is a gradually becomes a more and more consummate union, until in the kind of messianic era, we step into the reality of what's called in Hasidic writings, based on a pasuk, Eishes Chayil, based on a pasuk of Eishes Chayil, which is Eishes Chayil Ateret Baalah. The woman of valor is the crown to her husband. The crown sits upon the head. The halo of lights is really like, up until this point, the masculine has really had the higher reach and is pulling down the lights from the upper worlds and bringing them down so that they are also accessible to his bat zug, to the Shekhinah. But here there's been a reversal, and the Shekhinah, as I always say, like a spring compressed and released, she has propulsion power that takes her beyond the starting point, beyond the keter of her ben zug. And now she is serving that same function that he has served for her until now, which is to bring down her reach is higher, and to bring down the lights and consciousness from the upper worlds that ends up raising the two of them, raising him and raising the two of them. And that's kind of the messianic era that begins the whole multi-millennial Olam Haba, world to come. So let's see. Okay, so here we are. Yet at each step of the way, so as the Shekhinah, each, step, like step by step by step by micro step, really, she, the feminine, acquire increases in stature by integrating the consciousness, the sparks of consciousness that are connected to her soul, that that got lost in the after the eating of the tree of knowledge, and are being pulled back up and into her partsuf, into her stature. And at each step of the way, and so it's a work in progress, but still at each step of the way, it's perfect in regards to what is appropriate at that stage of development. In this way, their relationship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, and the Shekhinah, their relationship becomes ever more perfect without implying that it was anything less than perfect before. In reference to its endpoint, i.e., stage four and the messianic consummation achievement, there's room for improvement. But in reference to what's ideal at its current stage of development, it's perfect. The purpose of creation, the experience of actualized relationship, requires the whole journey, the means and the ends. I think I might have mentioned last week about the issue of, like, as in childhood development, that basically a child learns to crawl and then learns to walk, and sometimes a child skips the whole crawling thing and goes straight into walking, which you might think is like, wow, that's so evolved. But really, there's a whole neural connection of coordination between the hands and the feet and the right and the left, or whatever, that is essential to balance and full coordination as an adult. And so a child that skips crawling is actually disadvantaged in terms of their physical coordination in adult life. So it just as a way of understanding that, you know, all the stages of development, even though in and of themselves they are imperfect and flawed and lacking, but there's something that's acquired. It's kind of like in kind of fairy tales where the hero has to, you know, kind of come to this giant and get a coin from him and then find his way to another, I don't know, wizard and get a staff from him or whatever. And so that's our developmental process, is also that at each stage of the journey, there's something that we need to get in order that will be useful for us or even essential for us in our adulthood. So it requires the whole journey, the means and the ends. The term, if people have questions, you know, you can raise your hand. I think I'll see them. The term that best describes the trait that grows as a consequence of our deepening relationship with Hashem is Ruach HaKodesh. That's we've talked a lot about that, and that is, in some sense, really when everything gets pared away, that's that's the goal. Like, that's where it happens. That's that consummation of relationship that was the point of it all and the purpose of it all is embodied in Ruach HaKodesh. As I've said a lot, and I apologize for repetition, but the like the Ruach HaKodesh is in contrast to prophecy. That prophecy, in prophecy, the ego and personality of the prophet basically goes underground. It's like erased almost. The less involvement it has in the transmission, in the experience, in the transmission, the more authoritative the prophecy. So it has an advantage, is that the prophet is able to say Ko Amar Hashem, because he's not really like he's not involved in the content of the transmission, and so it's pure. It is exactly as Hashem spoke. Whereas the person with Ruach HaKodesh, which is divine inspiration, or inspired, divinely inspired inspiration, is active in the encounter. Like the initiative comes from below. The initiative of prophecy comes from above. Hashem needs a message to be delivered, and so he initiates. Pulls a prophet out and transmits. The initiative for Ruach HaKodesh comes from below, where we have an interest or a need or a goal or a project, and we need some help with it. And we first of all start by trying to figure it out ourselves and to do make it happen, and that becomes the kli that pulls down Hashem's involvement, which is particular to the initiative that we started below. And Hashem meets us, and then a whole dialogue ensues, a dialogue that's both in speech and action. And it's a very it's understood to be a core encounter between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like core to core, because the creative, there's a the Kamarna Rebbe talks about in, and it comes up in the You Are What You Hate, a spiritually productive approach to enemies, that kind of the core, what the, like how are we affected by the world? And that our core is affected by our children and our creative expressions. Our next layer out, or I don't know what you would call it exactly, but the next layer of ourselves is affected by spouse, friends, and colleagues. And the more Wait, I didn't do this right. Creative expressions. Oh, right. And then the outermost layer is affected by our possessions and our, yeah, basically possessions. I think I'm kind of messing this up because I wrote it wrong in my notes. But so there is so, but. The point being that the core level is connected to our creative expression, which is kind of is like our life expression, our artistic expression, and our children, which are considered to be a connected to core. Whereas I was a little bit surprised, but he as he organizes things. The spouse is really a more external connection than children, and then comes property. So all this to say that Ruach HaKodesh is like the relationship between ourselves and Hashem is happening on a core-to-core level, the deepest that is possible, and it is. And as the involvement intensifies, kind of as the partnership intensifies, so it becomes, you can't even tease out who's saying what and what started here and who brought this down and who to conceive that. It's like it's just so enmeshed in the partnership of the project that it is a very, very profound dvekut. And so and so it has the pleasure of the dvekut, and it has the it's productive. It's like kind of transforming self, transforming world, and it is, and it's Well, I can't remember what I was going to say with number three, but that's okay. So I'm going to now read the text. The term that best describes the trait that grows as a consequence of our deepening relationship with Hashem is Ruach HaKodesh. We've seen that Ruach HaKodesh, unlike prophecy, is a partnership, a reverie of shared creativity. As such, it is a core-to-core intimacy, for creativity springs from the soul's inner depth. Ruach HaKodesh is not all or nothing. It's a skill and sensitivity that evolves in proportion to our authenticity and alignment with spiritual law. In Ruach HaKodesh, we express an interest and attempt to satisfy that interest through prayer, effort, research, etc. And those exertions serve as an atarutta dilatata, an arousal from below, that draws forth a complementary atarutta dila'ila, an arousal from above, that draws forth that, i.e., the Ruach HaKodesh, our providential assistance specific to our initiating interest. And Ruach HaKodesh,
Sorry, can we, is it, this might be a leap, but for Tu Bishvat and the sap is rising, Chaim, my husband, he said it's Maim Nukva, it's Hitorut Latata, the sap rising from below.
Oh yeah, nice. Yeah.
And Blue Moshe pointed out that there's the other paradigm where the roots are above.
Right.
And so in that paradigm, the sap rising would be the sap coming down from above to below. So a meeting.
Interesting. That's an, is that true? I'm not sure. But that's interesting to speculate. I'll just think about that.
Yeah, I thought it was a good day to pray for Ruach HaKodesh in any case.
Right, sure. As is every day.
Right. Right, exactly. Yes. I
So
also
that,
want to just so go ahead.
no, go ahead. I wasn't going to say anything. I mean, I was, yeah.
I also just wanted to, when you were talking about the developmental stages and children, I just want to bless us all that we should, like, every stage of our life's journey, that we should have that kind of knowing that this is like you have to go through the stages. You have to go, like, this is exactly where you're meant to be in this moment. And like it's getting those, whatever it is, it's getting the right brain, left, whatever it's doing. We're exact kind of that kind of chemla. I don't know what the right word is, compassion.
And like
We
in
should
those
really.
fairy tales, like you have to get the whisker of this giant and the coin from this. Like it's, there's something that we have to get from each one of those moments and
Right,
stages.
wrestling with those.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else have anything to say while we're paused? Shmuel,
I
Shmuel.
have. It's Yael. I just use my husband's account. Okay. All right. I should update my name. Question about, like, it may sound weird, but using Ruach HaKodesh to like ask for a future answer. Like, I had a situation where I was really invested in an outcome, and I like asked the question. I said, "Is this outcome going to occur?" And the answer was like no. And I suddenly like let go of my attachment because I had that answer. And then the following day, in this situation, the answer was no. And I remember just being like, okay, is this something like that we're not supposed to use? Do, or so I was just curious your take on that.
I mean, no, I think you can work with it. I think, I mean, that's part of the avoda of Ruach HaKodesh is to is to reality check, is to debrief, the situations. Like, so this happened, it happened this way or that way, and the result was good or not good or on point or not on point, and that then becomes information that it helps you to refine your relationship to Ruach HaKodesh going forward.
So,
And
like
so,
asking, like it almost feels like asking a question about the future is, I'm using the word is okay.
yeah,
Because,
I
like,
think
how do you trust that, like, when I got that answer and it was so clear to me, I remember being like, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. It might, like, that answer might not have been true. I don't,
yeah.
I, are you,
Well, that's, I mean, so it, there's nothing un, like that forbidden about that. But there
okay.
is, I mean, the thing about the future is that it could be that the possibilities of the future are much bigger than you are able to conceive of or whatever. And so inadvertently, you could theoretically narrow the options and kind of be part of the like self-fulfilling prophecy of the no, that like something other might have been possible. But in terms of I mean, for whatever reasons, it might, I mean, I'm not sure what they were, but
It was
to
a deal. I was working on a real estate deal and I was like really invested in it. And I said, are the sellers going to accept the client's offer? And the answer was like, no. And I remember just feeling really calm and being like, okay, like chill. Let's see what happens tomorrow. So that's to give more context, that was the situation.
And so the gain of doing that was that you kind of emotionally or energetically were resigned to that already in a certain way, so it wasn't such a disappointment. Is
It
that?
wasn't such an emotional fluctuation until I got there. It was almost like, we'll deal with it. We'll navigate the situation when that situation, whatever happens, but it almost like, let me let go and let me just like focus on other things.
So yeah, I mean, I don't think, I mean, I think, you could put a qualifier on it or something about but this is the message, but it just acknowledging that that's the message you got, and your intentions were sincere, and you debrief it afterwards and see if it was helpful and if it was right and all that.
And then I had one more question with the charts where you had the four stages, like one, two, three, four. What's the source for that, like teaching or that graph, or like where is that
Well,
source
that's
from?
the main, like all, the whole Kabbalistic writings on the nature of masculine and feminine is all about that. That's the Ari's model of the
Okay.
diminishing of the Miyut HaYareach, the diminishing of the moon. And I mean, it's not he, the illustration is mine, but the mechanism that it's illustrating is from the Ari.
Okay, thank you. And which svarim from the RE is this like kind of taken?
It's Chaim, but it's, I mean, he, but the particular chapter is the Miyut HaYareach, the diminishing of the moon, which is really the code word for all the teachings about the Shekhinah and the diminishment of the feminine,
And then one
the
more question.
seven stages, the seven stages of feminine development.
Okay, and then in one of the things you mentioned, like that we have an elevated like Ruach HaKodesh when we're aligned with the spiritual law, and I just was wondering if you could explain what you meant with that word of spiritual law. Is it referring to like if you keep mitzvot and you're more likely to have Ruach HaKodesh, or is it was that something else? I think it was like in the paragraph before. I don't have the book in front of me, so I'm just seeing the screen, but it.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, spiritual law is, the entire the Torah is really a textbook of
Okay.
spiritual law,
So
and
that, yeah.
it's just kind of an alignment with the basic structure of reality is to align oneself with spiritual law, and it is a practice that kind of that rectifies one's wills and desires and emotions in a way that is, I don't know how to ask to say it, but is in line with spiritual law, is in line with kind of the structure of reality, and the more aligned you are with the structure of reality, the more aligned you are, period.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know if I answered it so
No,
loud.
it was good. It was good. I just like I'm, good.
Okay. So Ruach HaKodesh does not happen in a vacuum, as we've talked.
Any chance I can get my question in? I'm so sorry.
Oh, sorry, I didn't see your hand. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that.
There it
First
is.
of all, hi, and apologies.
Hi,
Apologies for being away for so long, and what a delight to be here in this circle. You said something that really moved me. You said the kli of request in a project is what
Sunita.
pulls down Hashem's, I'm going to say, beneficence, whatever words you want to say, into the project. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more of the creation of that kli in order to create that arousal from below. Because saying it as a kli, as a vessel, creating that vessel within myself is very evocative and invitational.
Right. I mean, that's really the whole like science or mechanism of prayer, is that the kind of space of longing, funk like nature abhors a vacuum. So we experience a lack or a longing or something missing, and we and it awakens a desire to kind of fill that lack. And really, a master of prayer is someone who is able to articulate that lack in a way that is potent, to draw down the lights that are exactly configured to fill that lack, to fit that lack, and to fill that lack. And so, kind of the nature abhors a vacuum is kind of the where the power is to of prayer and of creating a kli. A kli is defined halakhically as an object that can hold more, and one could say, and longs to do so, even though it's inanimate in a certain way. Okay, so Ruach HaKodesh does not happen in a vacuum. And so, as we discussed earlier in the book, that the spinning fiery sword that guards Eden's way, which is halak, it's a symbol that is Kabbalistically understood to represent the Klipat Noga, which is the murky, is the all that aspect of life and of reality that is neither intrinsically holy because it's commanded, or intrinsically unholy because it's forbidden. It's all that whole neutral realm. It's called Klipat Noga. And it's also, and it, and so it's the place where are I invited to just express our preferences and but there's also express our preferences, but also to kind of be in touch, tune into what Hashem is communicating to us in terms of what's our soul designed to do? What, and to kind of then make choices about how to walk through life in a way that is aligned and nurturing of what we are designed to do. And so that Klipat No, and the other thing about the Klipat Noga is that it's constantly changing. It's not stable. And so there's, Hashem is raining down this Ruach HaKodesh, but moment by moment by moment, the things change, the scene changes, and what Hashem is calling upon us to do is might be changing from one moment to next. And that's why the symbol of the revolving sword, that is where you have to get the message of the moment, and you can't rely on the message of the last moment, because you might get the sword might cut through. And so that becomes really the last frontier. Like, that's what our mitzvot are, and the habit of them is hardwiring our nerve net to kind of be in line with spiritual law. But that's not going to get us back into Gan Eden. To back into Gan Eden, we have to get through this fiery sword turnstile, that where there's no, we can't open a code of law or a rule book and find out what to do. We have to just get the message of the moment, and then the next moment, and then the next moment. And that's a we become Ruach HaKodesh. Like, it's like not just that we are applying Ruach HaKodesh or drawing forth Ruach HaKodesh. We have to kind of become Ruach HaKodesh in a certain way, of which is really what does that mean? It means really to just be tuned in to Hashem and truth, and kind of the panemiut, the message of the moment, and the panemiut of the moment. So let me start this again. Yet Ruach HaKodesh does not happen in a vacuum. The spinning fiery sword that guards Eden's way, the turnstile back into Gan Eden, symbolizes the Klipat Noga according to Kabbalah. It's the murky nature of our reality post-Eden, where everything is shades of gray. Our challenge is to find the most spiritually productive option in any given moment, the right balance of surrender and insistence. See, all of these are paradoxical polarities, where both of them are good, but you have to decide in any given moment which one is the priority. So the right balance of surrender and insistence, giving and receiving, exertion and stillness, work and play, discipline and spontaneity, judgment and tolerance, etc. That's the nature of Klipat Noga. There is always a continuum of paradoxical truths, and we must find the proportions best suited to the circumstance at hand. It's a very subtle discernment that there's kind of no way out. We have to become masters of it in order to really step into our messianic era. On the one hand, we need Ru so, but it's a catch-22. On one hand, we need Ruach HaKodesh to sort these things out. Yet on the other hand, Ruach HaKodesh is the prize that awaits us after the fact, after we've chosen right and found our way through that daunting turnstile. And that's how it goes. We work with what we have, dodge the sword as best we can, encounter its burn and sharp edge, which is always cleansing. Each cycle of this is, I mean, for people that have joined the class more recently, this is all ideas that have were developed at great length in the early parts of the book. Each cycle of fall and tshuva enables us in the, like Yuri Dal at Tzarech Aliyah, enables us to hold more light. Ruach HaKodesh settles into the new spaces of our slightly more enlightened self as the psyche prepares for another round of perfecting, of decision-making. With each cycle, the ego gets a little more transparent. part of the point of shame, one reason Hashem made it a universal part of life, is that it serves as an indicator that there is still ego work to do, to be done. Susceptibility to shame is evidence that the ego still has densities that need to be sanded down, a job that the discomforts produced by our run-ins with the spinning fiery sword are designed to achieve. It's quite elegant how it all fits together, the problem, i.e., ego density, and its solution, the fiery sword. One could think of the fiery revolving sword as an Ani detector, we go through the airport as a metal detector. So there is the revolving fiery sword is an Ani detector. The alarm that flashes when it spots ego density or opacity is a jolt of burning shame, whose fire then incinerates the impurities, i.e., the Zohama, that produce the constrictions that densified the ego, that triggered the Ani detector's alarm. It seems that the ego must be transparent to claim its Edenic birthright. There's no escaping the dictum that pride precedes a fall. Gonna keep going. Every moment is a communication between Hashem and our soul. But the weak link is that our ego, or Ani, is the one that interprets the communique and decides whether and how to respond to it. Yet the ego is allergic to shame and will do whatever is necessary to avoid its indignity. The denser the ego, the more susceptible it is to the warping produced by shame. In a masterful sleight of hand, the ego deflects the shame onto a convenient scapegoat and then convinces itself that the shame really does belong there. That twist is the gateway to baseless hatred. I mean, it's easier said than done, but but it is well said. I mean, that's just there's no getting around it. That is how it works. The warping of perception that protects the ego from facing shame happens so stealthily that we're completely unaware that our perceptions have been hijacked and that we are only seeing a concocted litany of despicable traits. It's the identical but inverted blindness that characterizes romantic love, where in that case one sees only the quote unquote perfections of the person until in due time they sadly give way to a catalog of unbearable irritations, which were there all along but which were brushstroked out of the picture. I don't mean to be cynical, but anyway, how it works. This brings us to the primary polarity that underlies all the varied continuums of Klipat Noga that arise in daily life. It's no surprise that it's paradox. So wait, the primary polarity being the Ani Ayin alternation. That in its unrefined expression is shame and narcissism, but in its refined expression is Ani and Ayin in a as a pulse that underlies all the varied continuums of Klipat Noga that arise in daily life. It's no surprise that its paradox is also the one most relevant to our subject at hand, the cosmic pulse of Ani and Ayin, yes self and no self, as we've seen. Because the relationship every relationship is there is an alternation. It has two polarities built into it of merging and differentiating, merging and differentiating. The merging is the ion phase, like one just kind of dissolves into the other. And then the differentiating is the ani phase, where one kind of recollects themselves and with and bound themselves and their boundaries and kind of return to their eye center, like rejuvenate their eye center. And so, and there is this alternation that the relationship is only a relationship because it has these two poles, that it the ani or eye center preserves the two-ness that is essential to the very definition of relationship. And the ayin, the no self, is the merger that is the consummation of the union. And so so the Kabbalistic roots of shame and narcissism trace back to that most primal heartbeat of creation, the Ani Ayin. The divine soul tugs us toward Ayin, and the animal soul, our vital soul, tugs us toward Ani. The priorities regularly clash. The divine soul's reflex is to surrender. It's always willing to die for truth, nullify its will, and merge with the Holy One. Conversely, the animal soul's or vital soul's job is to resist dissolution in order to keep ourselves and our ego alive, because there's no relationship without us. There is some potential that we must actualize to the nth degree in the course of our 120 years, which requires us to resist the herd and stubbornly follow our inner guide. Scientists pondering the uneven distribution of galaxies in the cosmos noted its noted its similarity to the opacities within an ice cube, and wondered if these phenomena might be related. Like in the cosmos, there are these wisps of matter that are the galaxies or super galaxies like Milky Ways, but most of the universe is just empty vacuum. Vacuum is no matter, like empty space. And so the question is, what causes this empty space to over here and over there to produce these wisps of matter, of materiality? And the arrangement of the wisps of materiality within the vacuum of space, the arrangements they make are similar to the whiffs of opacity that happen inside an ice cube. So in the ice cube, as water freezes, crystals form at different points and grow toward the center. As each front advances, it absorbs newly freezing molecules, which align with that crystal's orientation. When everything faces the same direction, the crystal is transparent. However, as it grows toward the center, it encounters other developing crystals with different starting points, angled in different directions. When those differently angled crystals meet, their front edges get pushed out of line, and those irregularities appear opaque. Here's an image of what happens. You can see, so the as its crystals are coming from a lot of different directions, and when the different directions collide, they push everything out of line, and it creates the chaos of the that is the opacity. As above, so below. A similar process occurs Wait, from our perspective, wait a minute. There we go. Scientists speculate that as the universe solidified after the Big Bang, a similar process occurred, and galaxies are the places where differently angled planes met, producing the opacity that we call matter, which comprises the physical stuff of our world. From our perspective, those cosmic wisps of solid ground are where it all happens, as opposed to the vast tracts of empty space that fill most of our universe. As above, so below. A similar process occurs in the psyche when its two souls meet and their orientations collide. Those zones of misalignment between Ani and Ayin, self, I sent like self center and Ayin self surrender, are the densities in our, these zones of misalignment between those two are the densities in our life that demand attention. The existential content that becomes our front of struggle and growth. Always, behind whatever else is happening, there is a negotiation between the divine soul and animal soul that is sometimes contentious and sometimes not. Theoretically, if they would both see the full picture, their urgings would synchronize, and the issue that seemed so real while they were fighting about it would simply dissolve. That's because its solidity arose from their misalignment, their clash about how to respond to the moment at hand. As they find more agreeable ways to differ, their incongruities smooth out, and the densities they produce gradually dissolve. Where there is no misalliance, that corner of life is transparent. It just flows. The task of harmonizing our Ayin and Ani soul centers is a lifetime journey from what Kabbalistic calls katnut to gadlut, from immaturity to enlightenment. So I was going to just read a little something about Tu B'Shvat, but we're kind of in the middle. I don't know, it's not so simple to pause here, but I guess we could. Do people have any preference? Do you want to do a little bit about Tu B'Shvat, or do you want to continue where we are? Malka Sima raised hand.
Yeah, I had a reason. I just had a small comment, but and then I'll do my preference. I don't if it just it strikes me that it's likely that our bodies have a similar, like our fascia and the way we store trauma in our cells has a similar kind of what you're that shames what's happening when the Ayin and Ani and in the ice cubes. I'm guessing that our fascia and our our muscle tension, we're are also creating those constrictions, that it's a similar,
That makes sense.
that's, yeah. I guess I would love, it is so juicy, it is hard to stop, and it would be great. Tu B'Shvat's here. I would vote for Tu B'Shvat. I'm open to, obviously, to whatever other people.
Tu B'Shvat.
Tu B'Shvat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Think it might help us harmonize our Ayin and Ani soul centers.
That's true. That's true. Okay. So, okay. So Rav Sadok talks about Tu B'Shvat as Vani Yareti Mitok Simchati Vesamachti Mitok Yirati. I bring awe into my joy and joy into my awe, meaning that Tu B'Shvat is not such a simple It's a kind of a bit of a complicated day. Okay, so this first part might be familiar more or less from anyone who's read Idias Tecum. But anyway, that sentence that I just read from the Medrash encapsulates the mood of Tu B'Shvat, of the Tu B'Shvat Seder. On one hand, we're surrounded. Wait, let me just hold on.
Is this in your Tu B'Shvat Haggadah, Saridi? Which page? If you're looking at it
I
from there,
think
I don't
it's
know.
seven. I think it's seven. No, it's 16. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay. So, but this, I think it's important. This is like the setting of the mood. So that sentence from the Medrash encapsulates the mood of a Tu B'Shvat Seder. On one hand, we're surrounded by abundance of every sort, the opulence of our earth and our holy land of milk and honey. Yet on the other hand, our task is deadly serious. According to Rav Tzadok HaKohen, we are reenacting, it's like a rebirthing. We're reenacting life in Gan Eden before the sin. For the Torah informs us that Adam and Chava were fruitarians. They had two explicit commandments. One was positive obligation to do something, and one was a negative obligation to refrain from doing something. And both commands related to eating. From all the trees of the garden, you shall surely eat, a positive command. But from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat from it, for on the day you eat from it, you will surely die, a negative command. Clearly, the primary focus of Adam and Chava's religious life was eating as a spiritual practice. So when we sit before our Tu B'Shvat spread, our table filled with fruits of every sort, it's as if we've returned to Gan Eden and are fulfilling the one explicit positive commandment that we received there, the most ancient commandment in the Torah, except perhaps a call to be fruitful and multiply. It's really pretty awesome in its simple way that this like command, how many millennia ago that we are in our postmodern selves sitting at a table fulfilling that mitzvah. It's really something. So could it be, let's see, yet how do we fulfill the, so wait, so yeah. So how do we fulfill the negative commandment of not eating from the tree of knowledge, especially since many of the fruits on the table are actually purported to be the infamous tree of knowledge? One rabbi says it was a fig, another says grapes, another says wheat. In fact, for all the seven species of fruit indigenous to Israel, plus etrog and perhaps even apple, there is a speculation in our ancient texts that it was the forbidden tree. The first nine fruits on our agenda today are exactly those suspected of being the tree of knowledge. So could it be that we are brazenly disobeying Hashem's directive and eating dafka from the tree of knowledge, i.e., the olives, dates, grapes, etc., that the Zohar identifies as a forbidden fruit? Obviously, it can't be that. So what's going on? Rav Tzadok explains, I just lost my place. Where did I, well, I just lost my place. What just happened?
So what's
So
going
what's
on,
going
Rav
on? There it
Sado?
is. Yeah. So, but it just keeps, I know what's happening. Wait a minute. You. Page display, enable scrolling. So what's going on? Rav Tzadok explains that the tree of knowledge was all of those suspected species and none of them at the same time. He says that the tree of knowledge was not a tree or a food or a thing at all. Rather, it was a way of eating. Whenever we grab pleasure from the world in a way that disconnects us from the creator, we fall in that moment from God consciousness and eat from the tree of knowledge. We take the gift and leave the giver behind. And so At our Tu B'Shvat Seder, we have a special opportunity to rectify Adam's sin. We're fulfilling his positive command by eating all this variety of fruits, and we can also fulfill his negative command and bring tikkun to that first sin, which we all participated in and consented to. Tonight we can choose not to eat from the tree of knowledge, which means not to forget about Hashem while we're eating our fruit and enjoying its taste and satiation. In the moment of our blessing, chewing, tasting, enjoying, swallowing the fruits, we should close our eyes and thank Hashem, meditate on his name, commune prayerfully in our hearts, each person in their own way, whatever is comfortable. And so on the Tu B'Shvat Seder, or even if you don't have a Seder but are just eating fruits in honor of the day, it's as if we are transported back to Gan Eden and are given the opportunity to revisit and redo that fateful event, and this time do it right. It's a therapeutic process as well as an opportunity for deep soul fixing. By doing it right this time and fulfilling both commandments as best we can, we bring light, fixing, and healing to the deepest crack in our collective soul that is the cause behind the cause behind the cause of all disease, imbalance, sin, and neurosis in the universe. And that's another way, and there's another way that our Tu B'Shvat Seder heals. Fruit trees are the pinnacles of the vegetable kingdom. Yet since we human beings are a microcosm of the universe, we have an inner plant layer with its own equivalent of fruit trees that begins its new cycle as well. Tu B'Shvat is the beginning of a new cycle of growth and health. So we have an inner layer that is a vegetable layer that begins its new cycle of health and as well. This layer of soul is the one that's responsible for the vegetative functions that underlie our physical health. Our cell divisions, circulation, respiration, metabolism, etc. So much of our health is really originates with the vegetable layer of our soul. The new year's fresh start brings an opportunity for us to regroup, correct imbalances, and bring a new cycle of health. Curiously, how do we use the energies available on this New Year's Day for fruit trees? The tradition is simple. Eat fruits of all sorts. Admire the shape, color, taste, and uniqueness of each one, and say blessings with deep intention. This is actually a powerful practice. It conveys a deep secret about how to exert positive influence over the body's vegetable layer that operates beyond conscious control. You can't really talk to your vegetable layer and tell it to make good fruit. It's happening outside our conscious control, and oversees our physical, but is the one that is what oversees our physical well-being primarily. By surrounding ourselves with fruits of every sort, the successful harvest of last year's cycle, we impress the picture of robust health onto the fruit tree layer of ourselves using symbols that are meaningful to it. The form and color of each fruit is an icon that triggers associations in the plant layer of soul. These subliminal suggestions of health and success penetrate the unconscious and leave transformation in their wake. Each fruit expresses a unique way of turning raw materials into something that is beautiful, healthy, and life-nurturing. A Tu B'Shvat prayer from the Pre-Eitz Hadar. Avi Adoni Dodi. Let it be that our eating of these fruits and the blessings recited over them and our talk about their spiritual roots, may it draw down bounty and blessing upon them and upon the whole chain of angelic unfolding that sustains them. They should flourish from the beginning of the year unto its end, both they and us, for blessing, for good life, for health, and for peace.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Anybody have any last questions before we part ways?
Happy Tu Bishvat.
Yes, happy Tu Bishvat to you.
Thank you for that teaching on Tu
Yes.
Bishvat. It was so needed. I didn't, I was so engrossed in the other teaching. I didn't want to stop, but I'm so glad we did. We can pick it up next time, hopefully.
Great. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank
you
you
so
so much. Thank
much.
you so much. Thank you.
Shavua
Shavua tov.
Toda,
you.
toda, shavua
Bye bye.
tov.
Whoops.